This is Ed Murrow. Listen to the sworn statement of an informer, now in hiding, afraid he will be found and killed.
I, Orestes Portales y Carrasco, do hereby depose under oath as follows. During the last week of February 1956, I was contacted in Miami, Florida, by a Spanish expatriate who claimed to be in the service of Generalissimo Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic. This man, henceforth identified as Felix Velasquez, related to me that he had been sent to the United States by Rafael Trujillo with the assignment to make arrangements for the assassination of Dr. Jesus de Galindez of New York City.
Dr. Jesus de Galindez, journalist and instructor at Columbia University, disappeared from New York City on the night of March 12, 1956. This is his description, as broadcast by the Missing Persons Bureau, New York City Police Department, in a 13-state alarm.
Alarm number 5922. Missing since March 13, 1956, Jesus D. Galindez of 35th Avenue, male, white, 42. 6'1", 160 pounds, slim build, fair complexion, light brown hair, slightly bald in front, brown eyes, good teeth, usually wears a fedora, reported missing in the 8th Precinct.
On December 3, 1956, another man connected with this case disappeared in the Dominican Republic. His mother gave us this description of her son, a young flyer from Eugene, Oregon, named Gerald Lester Murphy.
Jerry's height is 5 feet 10 inches, his weight about 165 pounds. He has large blue eyes and brown hair.
In the next hour, we shall attempt to chronicle in sound the actual case histories of Jesus de Galindez and Jerry Murphy. More is involved here than the disappearance of two men. A foreign government is confronted with charges of complicity in kidnapping, murder, and terrorization of American citizens. It also stands accused of maintaining in this nation a network of unregistered agents. These charges are under investigation by the State Department, the FBI, and by a federal grand jury now hearing secret testimony in Washington, D.C. We do not know when the results of these investigations will be made known, but much information concerning the Galindez-Murphy case already has appeared in newspapers and magazines from New York to Buenos Aires. The case itself is fast becoming an inter-American cause célèbre. Tonight, you will hear the tape-recorded words and actual voices of people involved in it, including key witnesses, speaking publicly for the first time, and some anonymously because they fear for their lives. The facts will speak for themselves. It is not our purpose to judge them. It is not our purpose to solve this case, but to chronicle its history. Our chronicle begins with a police report on the background of Dr. Jesus de Galindez. The speaker is New York's Deputy Police Commissioner, Walter Arm.
Our investigation has shown so far that Mr. De Galindez was born in Madrid, Spain on October 12th of 1915, and that he has a father and a brother who are still in Spain and who are his only relatives, as far as we can learn. Mr. De Galindez had been active in the Spanish Revolution and fled Spain shortly after the Franco regime came into power. He went to the Dominican Republic, where he was employed by President Trujillo as a tutor for his children.
Galindez went to work for Trujillo in 1939. Rafael Leonida Trujillo Molina has many titles, but they add up to one word, dictator. With the help of bullets, bayonets, and bodyguards, Trujillo has remained dictator of the Dominican Republic for 27 years. His realm shares the island of Santo Domingo with the Republic of Haiti. It is 4 hours flying time from Miami, a tropical Caribbean country of nearly 2.5 million people. Galindez worked for Trujillo as a tutor, a law instructor, and a legal advisor to the Department of Labor. For nearly 7 years, Galindez made voluminous notes on the modus operandi of the Trujillo dictatorship, which he had grown to hate. And he took these notes with him when he came to the United States. The report of the New York Police Department continues the story of Galindez.
He came to New York on February 14th of 1946. He described himself then as, quote, stateless, unquote, and joined the faculty of Columbia University as an instructor in international law and Spanish. He joined the faculty on October 1st, 1951. He was also the representative of the Spanish Basque government in exile.
Columbia University's president, Grayson Kirk, says, Galindez was a scholar well respected by his teaching colleagues. The colleague who knew him best was his advisor, Frank Tannenbaum, professor of Latin American history.
Dr. Galindez was a fine human being, a good Christian, a devoted Democrat, and a person who had great moral and political courage.
Under the guidance of Professor Tannenbaum, Galindez began work on a PhD thesis. His subject, the dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo. He called this work The Era of Trujillo. And while he wrote, he spoke openly against the dictator. A friend, Wenzel Brown, testifies to that.
Galindez made an awful lot of speeches attacking Trujillo. I particularly remember one speech that was made in an open-air ceremony in memory of Andres Requena, who was shot and killed in New York after publishing a newspaper attacking Trujillo. Now, in this speech, Galindez made a direct statement accusing Trujillo of arranging for Requena's murder.
Andres Requena was murdered on October 2, 1952. In his last newspaper article, Requena said his life had been threatened by Felix Bernardino, then Dominican consul in New York. Bernardino denied this. The case is still unsolved. On April 28, 1935, another anti-Trujillo exile was shot and killed in New York. His name, Sergio Bencomi, former Secretary of War in the Dominican Republic. A grand jury indicted Chiqui Fuentes Rubirosa as the murderer. Rubirosa fled to the Dominican Republic, was trailed there by New York detectives who saw him in the uniform of a Dominican Army officer. Dominican police said they could not extradite Rubirosa because no such individual exists. The third critic of Trujillo in New York to be silenced was Jesus de Galindez. Galindez worked on his doctoral thesis, The Era of Trujillo, from 1952 through 1955. His advisor at Columbia University, Professor Frank Tannenbaum, told us,
I know that he felt insecure. I know that he deposited a copy of the chapters as he wrote them with a friend, just in case something happened to him.
A Columbia student, Maria Joy.
As the classes went along, he mentioned the fact that he has been threatened by Trujillo people.
A friend, Norman Thomas.
The last time I saw Dr. de Galindez was by accident on the Columbia University campus. After talking for a few minutes, both of us were in a hurry, he said almost casually, by the way, I've been getting some more threats.
A Dominican exile, Nicolas Silva.
Galindez tell me that he has received threat over the phone telling him to quit writing against Trujillo or else he will disappear from New York City.
An excerpt from a letter written by Dr. Galindez to a Dominican exile, Dr. Angel Morales. The letter is dated June 15, 1955. A friend, Francis Grant, reads the actual words of Jesus de Galindez.
He ends this letter by saying the following word to Dr. Morales. I continue to smell the Trujillo pressure trying to amortize me.
2 weeks before he disappeared, Galindez stood before a distinguished academic committee at Columbia University. He was there for an oral examination known as the defense of the thesis. In his thesis, Galindez wrote that Trujillo was responsible for political assassinations, had destroyed all political opposition, built up a spy service abroad to check on Dominicans away from home, had made the Dominican Republic his personal fief. Columbia University accepted the Galindez thesis on February 27, 1956. Professor Frank Tannenbaum was on the academic committee that judged it.
The Galindez book is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the committee that examined the thesis, an important contribution to political science because it describes for the first time the detailed operations, the day-to-day operations of a dictatorial government over a period of 30 years.
Others had written critically of the Trujillo regime, but the Galindez thesis would be regarded as bearing the stamp of approval and the prestige of a leading university. Galindez also had begun work on another book, a withering satirical novel about the family and marital affairs of a dictator in the Caribbean. Galindez completed 3 chapters of his novel before he disappeared on Monday, March 12, 1956. Most of that day, he worked in his 4-room bachelor apartment at 35th Avenue, writing and preparing for his lecture that night at Columbia University. He began his lecture on Latin American politics at 8:30 p.m. Student Luigi Romano recalls his opening remarks.
The night he disappeared, he showed us his thesis, which had been approved, and then he said, well, I've been receiving anonymous telephone calls, but I'm going on. He implied that these telephone calls were due to some kind of stealing from the Dominican Republic about the publication of the thesis.
At 9:20 p.m., Dr. Galindez completed his lecture and left the university. The New York City Police Report continues.
Mr. De Galindez left the university in company with one of his students, a girl who drove him as far as 57th Street and 8th Avenue, where she later reported he got out of her car and entered the subway to go home.
The police will not disclose the name of this girl student. She was the last person to see Galindez before he disappeared, this night, March 12, 1956. The next day, March 13, a friend called his apartment at 10:30 a.m. There was no answer. On March 14, Galindez missed a scheduled class at Columbia and an important Spanish society meeting he had promised to attend. Friends and associates at that meeting began to check up, without result. Stanley Ross, publisher of a Spanish language newspaper, called the police 2 days later.
Friday, we began to get really worried, and I called the Missing Persons Bureau. They said they would not accept my report of disappearance because I was not a relative. They wouldn't accept it, and they said that you'd better wait a few days. He may have gone off with some girl someplace, and you may embarrass him if you try to find him. I waited till about 10 p.m. We got very nervous, and I called the FBI at about 10:30 p.m., told them what I was afraid of. They called me back in an hour and said, yes, Galindez had himself been afraid of something happening to him, that several months before, he had reported to the FBI that he thought his life was in danger. Saturday the 17th, the man from the FBI came down and said that they couldn't handle a case themselves because it was a local matter so far. Therefore, they would have to ask me to go to the local police, which I did.
The police record continues.
10 a.m. on March 18th of 1956. Stanley Ross, publisher of the Spanish language newspaper, El Diario del Nueva York, reported to detectives of the 8th Detective Squad that his friend, a writer of a political column for El Diario, Jesus D. Galindez, had disappeared from his residence at 35th Avenue. The detectives began an immediate investigation. Members of this department visited his home.
Detectives searched the apartment. Stanley Ross and two of Galindez's close friends were present. Here's what they saw, in the words of Ross and a friend who must remain anonymous.
The bed didn't look like it has been sleeping. No clothes on chairs. It's only the pair of shoes I wear on the floor, and that was all.
We noticed that the Monday morning papers were on his bed seemed to have been untouched. The desk was as I'd usually seen it, and we found an outline of this new projected novel I followed on horseback.
Miss Miranda started to look for anything that could be amiss in the apartment, but she found everything in order, everything in its place.
We did notice that a briefcase that Galindez sometimes carried didn't seem to be there.
And here are the official comments of the New York City Police Department in response to a reporter's questions.
Commissioner, in the opinion of the police department, did Dr. De Galindez reach his apartment on March 12th?
We have no evidence to show that one way or the other.
Was the briefcase that Dr. De Galindez carried with him to his classes at Columbia University on the night of his disappearance found in his apartment?
That, too, we will not comment on.
Is there any reason to believe that De Galindez disappeared voluntarily?
We have no evidence to that effect.
Does the New York City Police Department connect this case in any way with the previous murders of rebel Dominican leaders in New York City?
We have no comment on it.
Prior to Dr. De Galindez's disappearance, did he ask for New York City Police Department protection?
No, we have no record of Dr. De Galindez ever seeking such protection.
On March 18, 1956, the Galindez case was assigned as follows.
As there was no evidence of foul play, it was assigned to the Missing Persons Bureau. It made checks at hospitals and morgues, and they are still checking unidentified bodies in an attempt to ascertain whether any of these bodies might be that of D. Galindez.
Officially, Galindez became a missing person, just one among 10,000 people who disappear from New York City each year. His disappearance brought this reaction from one of his Columbia University students, Maria Joy.
When he told us several times about the threats I was afraid he was trying to make a hero of himself, exaggerating a little bit. But when I read in the New York Times that he had disappeared, I was horrified, not only because he had disappeared and then I realized what could have happened to him, but because that could happen in the United States.
In New York's Spanish community, CBS radio reporters found friends of Galindez who refused to discuss his disappearance. This man explains why.
After Galindez disappeared, most Latin American people seemed to be afraid. There seemed to be an atmosphere of terror, fear. People were afraid to talk about Galindez's case. They were afraid to mention his supposed enemy.
Why does this atmosphere of terror exist in a city of the United States? Our reporter found a friend of Dr. Galindez who told him why she was afraid.
Yes, I have been threatened. They asked if I receive any information, not to give it to the police, but give it to a particular party that I don't want to mention.
Could you tell me what that threat was?
Well, he didn't say directly, but he implicated that, thinking that I was from Santo Domingo, that if I talk, my family would be subject to some harm or something, you see.
Did they threaten you directly?
Yes, it was directly to me. So my answer was that I wasn't afraid because I wasn't a Dominican. I wouldn't talk to anybody else, though. I wouldn't give any information to nobody but the police department.
We do not know who threatened this woman. We do know that several Dominican exiles in New York City have asked for police protection. We do know that 2 weeks before the disappearance of Dr. Galindez, police told one of these exiles that his life was in danger. And 6 detectives guarded him night and day for 1 week. This exile is Dr. Herman Ornesco Isco, former publisher of the leading newspaper in the Dominican Republic. On March 30, 1956, Dr. Ornes told the New York Times,
I am afraid that Galindez has been kidnapped by agents of the Dominican regime. I know from my own experience that Galindez was one of the pet hates of the Trujillo dictatorship.
The Times printed the Dominican reply on April 4, 1956. Here is an excerpt of that statement, which was signed by Dr. Manuel de Moya Alonso, Secretary of State without portfolio for the Dominican Republic.
Quote, it is well known that the intriguing hotbed of Upper New York City harbors many malcontents, and that Galindez has opposition in many other Latin governments which might have wished him harm. It is far out of character of Trujillo, and the times would fare better to look for other motivations. The Dominican Republic admits to having an efficient intelligence system and has made available its information on the international communist conspiracy to the United States, but it does not use hired killers to solve a world problem. End quote.
That statement was printed on April 4. The next day, police said they found the will of Galindez. In it, Galindez wrote, I am a believing Catholic, and I want to be buried according to the rites of my church. The police also reported another discovery.
Detectives found a note dated October 4th, 1952, tucked away in a book in Dr. D. Galindez's apartment. The note was signed with his name. In it, he asked the police to seek his enemies in the Dominican Republic in the event anything ever happened to him.
The note mentioned no names, presented no clues. But from the friends of Dr. Galindez, police heard of one suspect, a lame man with a glass eye, of whom Galindez was suspicious. Here are his actual words, read by a friend, Francis Grant.
I have before me a photostatic copy of a letter in which Dr. Galindez writes as follows, speaking of this same personality. This man came to visit me this afternoon. He told me a strange story of thieves, of some peculiar data, of personalities, but there are too many holes, too many absurdities and flagrant contradictions. I smell a plot of our mutual friend of San Cristobal, Trujillo. Now, further on in the same letter, he says, I have reinforced the chain on my apartment, and I am inclined to advise you to do the same. This was written in November 22, 1955.
That letter was written to Dr. Angel Morales, a Dominican exile living in Puerto Rico. This is the statement of a Dominican exile in New York, Nicholas Silva.
Galindo got very much suspicious about that man. He notified that, he told me, to the FBI and to the New York police. The men were already known as an international spy of Trujillo, a spy and fingerman of Trujillo. The man was seen late on February in Miami. He made a contact there with a Cuban man called Oreste Portales.
Here is the sworn and signed affidavit of Orestes Portales, as read by another man.
I, the undersigned Orestes Portales y Carrasco, do hereby depose under oath as follows. During the last week of February 1956, I was contacted in Miami, Florida, by a Spanish expatriate who claimed to be in the service of Generalissimo Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic. This man, henceforth identified as Felix Velasquez, who walked with a strong limp, related to me that he was an intelligence operative of long experience. Two, that he was wanted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Three, that he had been sent to the United States shortly prior to our first contact by Rafael Trujillo with the assignment to make arrangements for the assassination of Dr. Jesus de Galindez of New York City and another person, whom I do not wish to identify in this affidavit, but whom I have identified in my previous statement to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. On the occasion of my last contact with Felix Velasquez, he appeared agitated, complaining that the agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation were after him. He left Miami the same night after having made a telephone call to the Dominican consulate. Just before his departure, Felix Velasquez received a telegram. I saw the telegram. It bore a Dominican dateline and read, in Spanish, "Abandon mission, return immediately." There was no signature. Somewhat later, I learned from a friend in Miami that the man known to me as Felix Velasquez is a notorious international criminal known as El Cojo, or the Limp, who had been implicated in the murder of an anti-Trujillo labor leader named Pepe Hernandez in Havana, Cuba. I realized then that the information I had accidentally learned from Felix Velasquez may be significant, and I therefore reported it to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I am a Cuban national and do not belong to any Dominican political organization. I have no personal interest in Dominican politics. My only reason for volunteering this deposition is to establish the truth.
Witnesses say they saw the lame man known as El Cojo in New York City 1 month before Galindez disappeared. 1 month after his disappearance, the president of the Inter-American Press Association wrote an appeal to President Eisenhower. James C. Stallman reads an excerpt of his letter, dated April 28, 1956.
As the president of the Inter-American Press Association, I ask your personal interest in this particular case in the hope that the strong circumstantial evidence indicating the possibility, if not the probability, of kidnapping may be immediately and thoroughly investigated by the FBI.
President Eisenhower made his reply at a news conference on Thursday, May 10, 1956.
The Attorney General went after the case as quickly as it arose, went into New York City. The FBI is standing by on the first intimation that it has a right to step in. The city police of New York have it in hand. As far as the case now stands, it's a pure case of disappearance and not a case where the FBI has any right to step in.
That was also the administration's answer to 12 labor, civic, and inter-American organizations requesting FBI participation in the Galindez case. But pressure for an FBI investigation continued. Speaking as chairman of the Post-War World Council, Norman Thomas said,
"The federal authorities are very clearly playing the case down. I gathered the impression in Washington that it is considered a potentially troublesome issue. Trujillo professes to be our friend. He would certainly resent an inquiry. Furthermore, this could well be felt in the delicate balance of the Latin American bloc of the United Nations. Hence, we have this runaround."
May 25, 1956. The scene, a courtroom in Havana. Rafael Solec, a Cuban gangster indicted in the murder of a Dominican exile, told the court, "In 1953, I was offered $100,000 by a Dominican agent to assassinate Dr. Galindez. Soler said he turned the job down, called it too risky." On May 30, another charge made headlines.
"I, Nicolas Silva, representative in the United States of the Dominican Revolutionary Party, charge that Dr. Jesus de Galindez of Columbia University was thrown alive into the firebox of a boiler in the Dominican freighter SS Fundación in New York Harbor on order of Dictator Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic. I have the information from eyewitness, in fact. But I cannot reveal the source, however, because it might complicate the lives of him, this man, and his family as well in the Dominican Republic.
The SS Fundacion and another Dominican freighter were in New York Harbor at the time Galindez disappeared. When the Fundacion returned to New York from the Dominican Republic, police investigated Silfa's charge, issued this report on June 6, 1956.
Detectives examined the vessel's furnace. They also searched the entire ship from top to bottom and questioned the crew. There was no evidence found to support the allegation that DeGalindis met with death aboard the ship.
The mystery deepened in July 1956 when the New York Herald Tribune revealed that Galindez had collected $1,016,000 for the Basque government in exile, which he represented in this country. First reports suggested that half of this money was missing. But José de Aguirre, president of the Basque government, denied this.
This is not true. My statement is as follows. From this sum of $1,016,000, the Basque government in Paris keep about half the amount for its proper expenses. The remaining part, which the government also received, was given, according to the wishes of the donors, to the Basque political and labor organizations.
In September 1956, the Dominican government released a booklet entitled The Other Side of the Galindez Case, a memorandum to the American public from Generalissimo Rafael Trujillo. In it, Trujillo denied implication in the Galindez case. Then Trujillo said,
quote, "At least the following alternative hypotheses about the Galindez case merit the most careful and urgent attention. 1. Galindez, having discovered that his book could not be published in a form that would accomplish the kind of hurt to the Dominican Republic that he had in mind, pocketed his $500,000 and took refuge in a carefully prepared hideout. 2. Galindez was a confidence man, whose confreres liquidated him for shortchanging them. 3. Galindez was a communist agent, whose misfortune was that he suddenly became more useful to the communist apparatus dead than alive. In a word, the communist plot that I call Operation Galindez has been as successful as its perpetrators could have hoped for it to be. But it would not have succeeded at all had it not been able to count on the unwitting cooperation of the U.S. press." End quote.
Charges had been made. Charges had been answered. But there the baffling case of Jesus de Galindez rested, until a young American flyer named Jerry Murphy disappeared in the Dominican Republic on December 3, 1956. Then some of those who knew Murphy well began to speak to the FBI, and what they said threw a new light on the Galindez case. This is Murphy's fiancée, Celia Sally Kerr.
Jerry said then he flew to Galindez from Long Island to Dominican Republic. What they did with the person from there, I don't know. He never did mention that. And he said if he'd have known that first, he would have never had any part of it. But he didn't.
According to Sally Kerr, Jerry Murphy said he flew Galindez to the Dominican Republic on the night of March 12, 1956. Helped to kidnap him without knowing that he was participating in a crime. Credit for checking out this story and for publishing it first goes to Life magazine. Here, we shall attempt to trace Murphy's flight and other new aspects of his story through the actual words of key people involved in it. The story begins in Miami, Florida, where 23-year-old Jerry Murphy worked as a pilot, flying charter jobs for Tom Guthrie's air taxi service. In February 1956, Murphy told Guthrie he was quitting.
Jerry told me that during one of his trips, he had made the acquaintance of the parties that he had flown, and he'd offered him a pretty good job and said that he thought he could be influential in getting him on an airline. At the time, he didn't mention what airline it would be.
Murphy's lifelong ambition was to be a pilot. Imperfect vision had barred him from commercial airlines and from the Air Force, but not from flying. In his hometown, Eugene, Oregon, he soloed at 16. At 23, he earned a commercial license and moved to Miami to further his flying career. Now came the offer he had been waiting for. Who made that offer? This is the statement of a friend who must remain anonymous.
Jerry Murphy told me that after he quit his job with Tom Guthrie's air taxi service, he became the personal pilot of a high Dominican official, General Espiat.
General Arturo Espiat, a West Point graduate, a Dominican intelligence officer. Murphy's fiancée, Sally Kerr, says Espiat promised Jerry a job in the Dominican Airlines. But first, there was a special job to be done. A sick man to be flown from New York to the Dominican Republic in a Twin Beach aircraft.
He was asked if he could do this job, and Jerry said certainly he could, and he thought he could devise a method to refuel the plane, and if they wanted him to bring back a patient, he'd do it for them. They were certainly paying him for it.
Needed an aircraft for this flight. Murphy leased one from the Trade Air Company in Linden, New Jersey. A company spokesman describes the plane.
The airplane that Jerry Murphy leased from Trade Air here at Linden, New Jersey, on March 10, 1956, was a 1943 twin-engined, six-passenger, military surplus Beechcraft. The airplane was painted yellow with green striping and bore the CAA registration number 68100.
Murphy leased this plane for 1 month, said he got the $800 to lease it from two friends. One of them, John Frank, was indicted on May 13 by a federal grand jury as an unregistered agent of the Dominican Republic. Murphy paid the money to Tony Ming of the Trade Air Company.
He brought cash, and he said that he was proceeding to Newark Airport, where he would pick up one of his passengers prior to leaving for Miami, Florida, his next intended stop.
We found no record that Murphy landed at Newark Airport, but on March 11, 1956, a day before Dr. Galindez disappeared, Murphy and his leased Twin Beach were seen at an airport in Staten Island, New York, by this man who must remain anonymous.
There were, I'd say, probably three or four people around there, and I was curious, so I went over to see what was going on. When I looked inside the ship, I noticed the rear seat removed, and they were attempting to put these drums in there, I assumed, to carry more gasoline. I thought they were going to make a long trip. While they were working there, I just happened to ask the pilot where he was going, that he needed that much gasoline, and he was nice enough, and he said, well, he was going to make a trip down to the Azores, and then from there he's going to hop over to Africa.
The same day, March 11, Murphy drove out to Zons Airport in Long Island, told airport officials that he would land there the following day in a Twin Beach. The next day, he landed at 10:30 a.m., bought gas, signed the register, announced his departure time as half an hour later. But he did not take off till night, until after a so-called sick person was unloaded from an ambulance and carried aboard his plane. The night watchman at this field assisted in the operation. He died of a heart attack last fall. But he told his daughter about the sick man at Zons Airport.
On March the 12th, 1956, he told me of a case of a man who was being flown to Florida as last resort to help him. The man was supposed to be a millionaire, and my father helped put him on the plane. The people that were helping put the man on the plane told him that he was a cancer victim.
Later, Jerry Murphy told Sally Kerr about this specific sick man.
He said this person was brought in on an ambulance and had another person assisting him, was put in the plane, and he immediately knew the person was not a sick patient. He was drugged because he kept mumbling and saying nonsensical things and certainly wasn't a sick person.
This was the night Dr. Galindez disappeared. Next stop in Murphy's flight, Lantana Airport near West Palm Beach, Florida. Personnel at the airport were on hand to meet him. We learned that the airport was advised of his arrival by a phone call made 12 days earlier. Here is a description of the arrival of Murphy's plane on the morning of March 13, 1956 at Lantana Airport, West Palm Beach.
At approximately 7:30, the airplane, a Twin Beach N68100, approached our field from a northerly direction. I directed the airplane to a fueling area, and the pilot got out of the airplane and said, gas all of my tanks and bring my oil up to 7 gallons. From the pictures I've seen recently, the pilot of this airplane was Gerald Murphy.
This man did not enter Murphy's plane, but the cabin window was open, and something caused him to look inside.
Coming from the inside was a very strong smell or stench, and I saw a stretcher and a person laying on it, and assumed that it was a patient or a hospital case of some type. The cover looked like it went from head to foot, and it was a dark type material, might have been an old army blanket or something to that effect.
I saw one man sitting down on the left side of the airplane. He had on fairly dark clothing and had a hat on, a felt-type hat, and seemed about a middle-sized man.
In the early morning light, closer identification was impossible. Murphy himself filled the extra gas drums inside the plane, and he told this man...
He said that he was coming from the north and said that when he left here, he was going to go to Naples, Florida, on the west coast. He said that he was taking the person that was on the stretcher over there to a hospital of some type.
We find no record that Murphy landed on the west coast of Florida, and no record that he landed in the Azores, another stated destination. But later he told a pilot who flew with him in the Dominican Airlines.
Murphy told me that he had made a flight to the Dominican Republic in a Twin Beach. He had landed at a little town called Monte Cristi.
Who assisted Murphy in his flight? Who was the man seen sitting in the cabin of his plane at Lantana Airport? Sally Kerr says...
I do believe De La Moza was with him when he went on this trip because he mentioned him and he didn't mention any other names except that he did say that General Espaillat masterminded the whole plan.
Octavio De La Moza was a co-pilot in the Dominican Airlines and an officer in the Dominican Air Force. You will hear more about him in this program. General Espaillat later became the Dominican Consul General in New York. This is his authorized statement, written in a letter to CBS Radio by Harry C. Klemfis, Director, Dominican Republic Information Center.
Quote, the New York Consul General of the Dominican Republic, Honorable Arturo R. Espaillat, has authorized me to state that he positively did not meet Mr. Gerald Murphy prior to March 12, 1956, the date of Galinda's disappearance, thereby eliminating any conduit between the Consul General and Murphy in this regard. Secondly, Consul General Espaillat explains he did not arrive in this country from Ciudad Trujillo until April 1956, nearly a month following the Spanish Basque professor's disappearance. Since the consul was in the Dominican Republic when Galindez disappeared, it is obvious that reports of his connection with the Galindez disappearance are not true, end quote.
Here is a letter from Jerry Murphy. His mother, Mrs. Lester Murphy, reads it.
Jerry wrote to us on May the 22nd, 1956, and these are his words. General Espaillat, a very good friend of mine here, has moved to New York as the new consulate general. He was head of the armed forces and intelligence in Dominica. He is the one who put me in the airlines.
Murphy joined the Dominican Airlines in April, a month after his flight with the sick man. By then, he knew who this man was, according to Sally Kerr, and this is what happened.
He was getting restricted to the premises of Ciudad Trujillo for periods of times of 2 or 3 weeks when they more or less thought the investigation was getting hot in New York, and they would receive word from General Espaillat. I mailed some clippings to Jerry which concerned Generalissimo's denial of having taken part in anything concerning de Galindo's disappearance. Jerry said he received the clippings, but that he was warned that if he received any more of them, he would be in trouble.
Jerry Murphy met Sally Kerr while he was working for the Dominican Airlines. She was a Pan-American stewardess based in Miami. When they became engaged in September, Sally urged Murphy to break off with the Dominican Republic, told him, the same thing may happen to you that happened to Galindez. Murphy replied,
Jerry says, well, he's not harmed at all. He said, as a matter of fact, I saw Jesus de Galindez the other day. He said he's got as much freedom as you and I have, only he can't leave.
The testimony of a friend who must remain anonymous.
Back during the summer of 1956, I asked Murphy what he thought about the disappearance of Galindez and the tie-up with the Dominican government. And his reply at that time was, I can take you to Galindez in 10 minutes.
Friends noticed that Murphy lived far beyond his salary as a co-pilot. One example, he bought 2 new cars and paid cash for them. Questioned about this, he told a friend in the Dominican Republic.
Jerry told me that he was an agent for the Dominican government aside from being a co-pilot on the Dominican Airlines. In fact, he stated the salary that he was getting in return for working for the government there, $750 a month. His airline salary as a co-pilot was something like $350 a month. That would make, what, $1,100 a month total salary, plus bonuses for odd jobs.
According to this man, Murphy also talked about his connections with high Dominican officials.
He not only told me that he was going direct to the palace or that he'd be late for a luncheon appointment or even looked at his watch, I've seen him do that, but I have seen his car parked in the palace yard.
The testimony of another friend.
I have heard him mention several times that he had to go to the palace and pick up his other paycheck.
According to Sally Kerr, Jerry said he had been well paid for his part in the Galindez kidnapping, and he mentioned some other jobs.
Jerry mentioned three other things he was asked to do. One of them was to locate one person in Mexico. That's all he had to do, was contact the person and locate them. And for this, he was paid. Then another job he did do was he took over $30,000, which he gave to the professor of the university in Havana to finance a revolution, and he knew that. Jerry was then asked to go over as a tourist, take pictures, and look around and see if you could land a C-46 somewhere outside of Santiago. And this Jerry did do.
And here is the statement of another witness who told our reporter...
He once discussed carrying money to Cuba to back the revolution.
How much did he carry?
$500,000.
Do you think he knew or fathomed what he was actually doing?
I think he knew what he was doing, but I don't think he knew he was getting in as deep as he did.
Sally Kerr noticed Murphy preparing for one thing.
Jerry was a very conscientious person, and he understood more or less that someday he might be framed for this if it ever came to a head. So in order to protect himself, he gathered all the data he could on the dates, people, the place where this particular trip that he brought back to Galindez, because that was really the first one on which he got involved. So he had me type out all these papers for him, and he had them in a file. I said, well, Jerry, just don't leave them around where anyone can get to them.
Sally Kerr says she agreed to marry Murphy on one condition, that he quit his job as an agent for the Dominican Republic. He agreed. But according to their plan, he would remain as a co-pilot with the Dominican Airlines for a year or two, just so he could ease out of the Dominican Republic gradually without causing suspicion. But that plan didn't work out.
It was in November, just before Thanksgiving, when Jerry came on a weekend and he said, guess what? Naturally asked him what, and he said, well, Sally, I just quit my job. And I said, well, which one? He said, the one with the government. And he said, and I've already put in my resignation with the company. He says, I've had all I can take, and he seemed quite disgusted. So I always felt that they might have asked him to do something which was completely against his will.
What had Murphy been asked to do? Why had he suddenly quit? This is what he told a friend.
He told me that he was going to quit his work with the Dominican Republic because they asked him to do things that were fantastic and impossible for him to do. Later I heard that he said in the presence of others that one of the jobs he had been asked to do was to bomb the presidential palace in Havana for a bonus of $250,000. I was also told by the same party that Murphy stated that he wanted no part of the proposed bombing and wanted to get out of it.
And he told a friend in Miami.
Jerry came in to have a private talk with me, and the Miami Herald happened to be laying on the couch. And I guess there had been a revolution in Cuba, and it was on the headlines. But Jerry told me that he intended to come back to the States, that he was becoming too involved. And it all dovetailed around this article that was on the front page of the Miami Herald.
Murphy flew back to the Dominican Republic on Saturday, December 1, despite the plea of his fiancée, Sally Kerr.
I said, but Jerry, please don't go back. He said, well, Sally, I have to go back to sell my things and sell my car and get everything more or less together. I said, well, Jerry, can't someone do that for you? And I said, please don't go back. I begged him. And I just knew how those people operate. And I just knew they were waiting for him.
Sally Kerr is the last known person who saw Murphy before he disappeared. She saw him the afternoon of December 3, during a stopover of her Pan-American flight in the Dominican Republic.
Monday the 3rd, December 3rd, the day that they say he disappeared. And he told me he'd meet me at the plane. We stopped there for about 20 minutes on our way to Puerto Rico. So, naturally, if I had any doubts about Jerry's well-being, they certainly vanished when I saw him. He got on the plane, and he seemed to be the same carefree boy. And he says, well, everything's fine. He says, I'm going to sell my car tomorrow. I've got all my things packed and ready to sell. He said, and I have an appointment with the Generalissimo in 1 hour. And I said, well, with the Generalissimo, what does he want? He said, well, he said, he called me. He wants me to come to the palace. So he summoned him after he had resigned and everything, which naturally to me seemed very, very odd, but to Jerry didn't. So he went. That was the last time I saw him. I don't think he ever left that palace.
There is no evidence that Murphy reached the palace, but the time of his disappearance is pinpointed by this friend.
There's an hour and a half that you can pin it down to. Jerry was seen at the airport in the vicinity of 4 p.m., and Tommy Chapko and Red Metric witnessed seeing his car at about 5:30, which was dusk. They looked for Jerry's body, or they didn't know exactly what they would find, but they did look around the bushes around the car for a few minutes, but it was getting dark, and the policemen were watching them pretty close, and I guess they got afraid and left.
Those men who saw Jerry's car are American pilots in the Dominican Airlines. They found the car abandoned on a cliff near a slaughterhouse. The water below the cliff is 600 feet deep. Offal from the slaughterhouse drains into it, and sharks infest it. Dredging this water for Jerry's body could yield no result. Murphy had vanished, and his mother in Eugene, Oregon, received a call.
The State Department called us on December the 7th in the afternoon, asking if we had heard from Jerry since the 3rd of December, that they had found his car, but he was missing.
10 days later, Mr. Murphy and Sally Kerr went to the Dominican Republic to get information and to gather up Jerry's belongings. During the trip, Sally told Mr. Murphy about Jerry's connections with the Dominican government. And together, they told the story at the American Embassy in Ciudad Trujillo. This was the reaction.
The American Embassy didn't even know Jerry's connection with the government. When we informed them of what we knew concerning Jerry, they immediately knew that all those suicide alibis that the Dominican government was trying to establish by taking us out there and showing us a cliff and saying they'd found his car on the edge of it and that he must have been very despondent and jumped. Well, that was ridiculous. I told Ambassador Pfeiffer this in his office in the American Embassy, and he was stunned. And he said, does anyone else know that you know this? And I said, no, we have told no one else. He says, well, do not repeat any of this to anyone while you are here. He said, I have reason to believe that your life is in danger. He said, if that man knows that you know any of this, he won't let anyone stand in his way. One more life won't mean anything to him. He said, so what we'll do, he says, give you an escort. You get Jerry's personal things together, and we'll get you out of the country as soon as possible. So naturally, we were terrified. One of the Marine guards drove us around and would pick us up, and then the American consul, Mr. Laughlin, would go with us, escort us any other place we'd go. He never left us alone. We were always within their sight.
The ambassador denied to us that he told Sally Kerr that her life was in danger or that a Marine guard was assigned to protect them. Dominican police officials questioned Sally and Mr. Murphy.
We literally played the role and said all we knew was that Jerry had disappeared and that he had been very happy there with his job flying for the Dominican Republic, and that it was a mystery to us. And they made us sign statements. And that was all they were interested in. They just wanted to know how much we knew about Jerry. And they seemed very satisfied that we knew nothing. At least they thought we knew nothing.
Jerry's father, Lester Murphy.
They were very friendly, but they didn't answer any questions. They done nothing for us at all. All they done was ask us questions. They didn't answer any.
They took Mr. Murphy and Sally to Jerry's apartment in Ciudad Trujillo.
We proceeded to his apartment, which was in good order, but the first thing I wanted to locate was his suitcase. He had his insurance policies, and he had those papers I had typed out for him in that suitcase concerning the jobs he had done for the government. These we didn't find. We didn't find anything personal like that. All his clothes were there. Everything was in order. And they made a statement that nothing had been touched. I'm sure they went through the whole apartment first before we got there.
Sally and Mr. Murphy tried to get information from Jerry's friends in Ciudad Trujillo, found them uncooperative. One friend tells why.
We felt that the telephones to Mr. Murphy's room was tapped. He always refused any sort of conversation on the telephone or an appointment to speak with them, because the actual residents there feared Any possibility of them being linked up with dishing out information on what happened to Jerry?
After 4 days in Ciudad Trujillo, Sally Kerr and Mr. Murphy returned to Miami, where Sally got some advice from the FBI.
The FBI, they advised me. They said that they didn't think I was in any outright danger, but they did say that it was only 4 hours away from the Dominican Republic, and for precautionary reasons, it would be best if I'd return home or go home with Mr. Murphy. They said they'd think it'd be better that way, and so I did.
Sally stayed with the Murphys in Eugene, Oregon. There, they received a telegram containing information from the Dominican government. It said Jerry Murphy had been killed by a Dominican pilot, Octavio de la Maza. This was the same man who allegedly participated in the kidnapping of Jesus de Galindez. To Mrs. Murphy, the case seemed closed.
We accepted this telegram as a death notice that this Dominican had killed Jerry, and of course we felt as heartbroken and sad as anyone would feel when one of their loved ones has met with something like this, and we were prepared to just accept it as Jerry's death.
But others questioned the Dominican explanation. No one could question the accused murderer, de la Maza. He was dead. The Dominican government said he hanged himself in his prison cell with a mosquito net, left a suicide note to his wife, confessing the crime, explaining that remorse for the murder of Murphy had caused him to commit suicide. Congressman Charles O. Porter of Oregon took an interest in the Murphy case and in de la Maza's suicide note.
The note goes on to explain that he was out drinking with a man who'd been his enemy and drinking quite a bit. This man had insulted him, made an improper proposal, and had insulted him and his country. And then in the course of a fight, he knocked him into shark-filled waters and he couldn't rescue him. So this remorse is killing him because of this. Now this was the same man, mind you, who a few years earlier had killed a man in the Dominican Embassy in the British Isles. He didn't suffer any remorse from that, but here now, where he's killed a man who personally insulted him and his country and killed him by accident, he's got remorse and has to kill himself.
The Dominican government says de la Maza denied the crime when he was picked up as a suspect 2 weeks after Murphy disappeared. His suicide note to his wife was his only confession. The FBI examined this note and other documents presented by the Dominican officials. On March 16, 1957, the State Department released the content of its reply to the Dominican government. Here is the essence of it.
From an examination of these documents and other evidence, this government has concluded that if the specimens of handwriting submitted by the Dominican authorities as being those of de la Maza are actually his, then the suicide note was not written by de la Maza. Furthermore, this examination reveals a contradiction between the report of the Dominican Attorney General, which states in substance that Murphy's political influence in the Dominican Republic was the object of investigation without anything serious being produced to justify it, and other available information. Our investigations indicate that Murphy was well acquainted with high Dominican officials, among them the late Colonel Salvador Cobian and Brigadier General Arturo R. Espaillat. The government of the United States is gravely concerned about the disappearance of one of its citizens in the Dominican Republic. It assumes that this concern is shared by the Dominican Republic. In view of the foregoing observations and other evidence which it has developed within its domestic jurisdiction, the government of the United States considers the case of Gerald Lester Murphy as unsolved.
The Dominican reply to this note was a reaffirmation of its original explanation. Congressman Porter of Oregon pressed for a congressional investigation.
What I sought in Congress and what I shall continue to seek is a thorough inquiry into the matter. I believe there is strong evidence of a tie-in between the government of the Dominican Republic, the disappearance of Galindez, and the disappearance of Gerald Murphy. If Trujillo had nothing to fear from the facts, why doesn't he welcome an opportunity to clear his name, now besmirched by grave suspicion?
On March 7, 1957, Columbia University's Vice President and Provost, John A. Kraut, wrote to the New York Times,
"If events prove that a scholar, in the pursuit of knowledge and in the publication of that knowledge, has been torn from a free community of which he was a useful and inspiriting member, then the transgressor must be brought to justice to the end that intellectual freedom may endure, not only on Morningside Heights, but in centers of learning throughout the whole free world."
Norman Thomas, speaking for the International League for the Rights of Man.
We hereby offer $10,000 reward for evidence leading to the arrest and final conviction of any person or persons found guilty of abduction or murder of Dr. Jesus de Galindez of 35th Avenue, New York City. If any of you who are listening in tonight have any evidence that meets the requirements of this offer, we hope that you will at once communicate with Clifford Forster, Counsel for the International League of the Rights of Man, 155 Broadway, or Detective Hines of the 8th New York Detective Precinct, 253 Mercer Street, New York.
Who will come forward to present evidence in the Galindez-Murphy case? The voices of Galindez and Murphy have been silenced. De La Maza, the alleged killer of Murphy, is dead. The night watchman who helped load a sick man onto Murphy's plane at a Long Island airport is dead. El Cojo, the lame man who visited Galindez's New York apartment, disappeared in the Dominican Republic, according to Dominican police. Dominican police say El Cojo's wife is dead, killed in an automobile accident. Without witnesses, there is no evidence, no proof. But several indisputable facts in this case emerge. One is that many people connected with the case are afraid. One of them is a girl now living in Kansas, Sally Kerr.
I just don't feel sure. Nothing would surprise me. I have my doubts. I trust no one. I still look both ways before I cross the street. And even now in Kansas, I can't actually say I feel completely safe.
A friend of Jerry Murphy who must remain anonymous.
I feel very definitely that if I were pointed out or fingered as the one that definitely said or brought to light the fact that Jerry was working for the Dominican government and more or less put the Dominican government on a spot, I feel I would very definitely be liquidated, and I've stated that to the FBI, and I've asked for their protection. They've also given me a phone number to call immediately if I suspect anything, and they'll have an agent on the spot.
We cannot present the voices of 50 other people connected with this case. They would not record statements. Some said they had been threatened. Others said they were afraid to be involved, were afraid their voices would be recognized. A second indisputable fact is that the Galindez-Murphy case has raised charges against the Dominican Republic which transcend the disappearance of Galindez and Murphy. They are charges serious enough to be considered by a federal grand jury, now hearing secret testimony in Washington. Listen to Dr. Herman Ornez, until a year and a half ago, publisher of the leading newspaper in the Dominican Republic, now in exile in this country.
As a former publisher of El Caribe, and as a former high government official, I can tell that the network of Trujillo's agents that work in this country and are not registered is enormous. If someday the whole story comes to the open, the American public will be shocked.
Congressman Porter of Oregon writes in the June issue of Coronet magazine,
"The shocking fact is that a highly paid organization of killers is at large in our country, operating chiefly in New York City and Miami, whose job it is to assassinate or intimidate the enemies of Trujillo in the United States. They don't draw the line at expatriate Dominicans. They will murder Americans, too."
The Dominican government says there is not one shred of evidence on which these charges are based, that they emanate from leftists and communists intent on attacking the Trujillo regime. It would seem that the Galindez-Murphy case has provided ammunition for Trujillo's enemies. It would also seem that the charges made in this case warrant investigation by a grand jury and by the FBI. The investigation continues. We have attempted to chronicle certain events and accusations in the public interest. This is Ed Morrow. Good night.
CBS Radio has presented a report on the Galindez-Murphy case, a chronicle of terror. Narrated by Edward R. Murrow. Produced by Jay McMullen. Associated in production, Arthur Rabin and Ted Sack. This has been a CBS Public Affairs program.
Later this evening, most of these same stations will bring you a timely interview with Senator Arthur V. Watkins, Republican of Utah, on Capitol Cloakroom. Now stay tuned for Alan Jackson and 5 minutes of the CBS News, which follows immediately on most of these same stations.